I'm here with Damon Linker. Damon, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It's great to be here.
So many people will be familiar with your writing, but remind people of what you've been up to, these many years as a writer and a political commentator, and where they can find your stuff currently.
Well, it seems like everyone these days, I have a Substack titled Notes from the Middle Ground. And then I also teach political science at the University of Pennsylvania as a senior lecturer there. And I mainly teach courses in political theory and the political right.
Well, we're going to get into the political right and the theory or lack of theory that may apply to the current moment. How would you describe your politics at this point?
For the last decade or so, I've described myself as being a liberal on the center left. I used to be a conservative about 20 to 25 years ago. I was an editor at First Things magazine, which Andrew Sullivan once called the intellectual nerve center of the religious right. And so I spent some time in the midst of that during the Bush administration and became frustrated with some of the Bush policies, the Iraq war, opposition to same-sex marriage. And so broke from that, wrote a book about it called The Theocons. And since then, I've been on the broad center-left with the emphasis mainly on center. I'm really not that far to the left, but I do incline that way, mostly out of aversion to what the right has become. Although that's kind of amusing because that break, as I just said, was initiated under Bush. And now I look back at the Bush administration and it seems like the good old days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as do I. I don't think we've ever crossed paths, but I seem to remember you having some critical things to say about the new atheists. I don't know if those same criticisms still apply, and perhaps we'll get to some areas of disagreement. But when I look at your writing now, certainly on the topic of politics, you know, you and I are more or less in lockstep in how we view the current moment.
That sounds about right. I would expect that. Everything I've heard of you and your podcast and other media appearances, I think we're pretty simpatico. Yeah, I mean, I was critical of some of the new atheist writings at the time. That whole wave seems to have kind of dissipated and moved on to, well, we're talking about other things now, so it almost feels like ancient history. My second book called The Religious Test does have an essay in it that's critical of the new atheists, and you are in there along with your colleagues, the late Christopher Hitchens and the others, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, or...
Well, maybe we'll get there. Both of us talk about our worries at this point, perhaps ad nauseum. I wouldn't like it ever to be accurately said of me that I'm an alarmist around the changes that seem to be happening in our democracy. And I wouldn't want it said of you either in this context. So I would like us to, as a posture, to be as circumspect and sober as we can be, but I also don't want us to shy away from honestly analyzing what we think is happening here. So with that as my effort to lead the witness, what can you say about the current state of American democracy from your point of view?
Well, I certainly agree with the way you framed that. That's sort of my brand at my Substack, is to be sober and clear-eyed, honest about how things are going, and also not to, I don't really believe in pep talks, in trying to portray things as better than they are in order to buck up my own side. I think it's much better for liberals to stare resolutely at those who wish to do us harm and assess what it is they hate about us and what they want to do to us and in place of us if they firmly depose us. And only in doing that can we formulate a kind of coherent and reasonable response. The way it looks to me now, I have gone back and forth over the last, say, half decade to full decade, basically since Trump first, descended the escalator and began his first campaign. I've gone back and forth between fearing what a lot of people on the center left fear, which is a kind of dictatorship under this man who appears to have what I call a tyrannical soul, if you will, someone who longs to be a strong man and vanquish his enemies and punish those who do him any wrong, which he defines very broadly. So sometimes I worry about that, but at other times I worry about an alternative bad case scenario that intertwines with it in a kind of ominous way, and that is the United States spiraling into civil unrest. I'm hesitant to use the word civil war or the phrase civil war, which we hear so much of these days, unless we define precisely what we mean. I do not anticipate a new Antietam and Gettysburg and armies lining up against each other on battlefields and firing guns at each other, but other examples throughout history, like the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the Years of Lead in Italy, a kind of spiraling of tit-for-tat violence by radicals on both the far left and the far right, which, if left to their own devices, could devolve into a kind of ongoing chaos in which the economy can't really function well and day-to-day violence in our lives with bombings and shootings becoming so great that kind of public spaces become kind of emptied out as people try to just stay in their homes to avoid that violence. That's bad enough, but the way in which these two options intersect with each other is, I think, what alarms me most about the present moment, with the present being defined as the fall of 2025, because it does evolve over time, is the way that Trump and his most malign allies in the administration, foremost among them being Stephen Miller, the deputy White House chief of staff and senior advisor to the president, that they seem very eager to be given a pretext to clamp down on political dissent in a more radical way. And they are using any sign of violence by anyone who can be described as on the left as that pretext. And of course, the Charlie Kirk assassination was the biggest of these opportunities for them. They haven't, thankfully, moved, say, to invoke the Insurrection Act, which we can maybe talk a little bit more about later, in response to that assassination. But you now have Trump in the last couple of days actually invoking that act in his own name as something he's contemplating. He and Miller desperately want Portland to be burning to the ground so that they can use that as a pretext. They want Chicago to spiral with attacks on ICE officers by people on the street, which then the military can be sent in to defend the ICE officers. And then, you know, the administration would then hope that the left attacks the soldiers and that this would, intensify support for, again, a more militaristic power grab. It's really scary stuff. And so what do I fear most is exactly what I've just been describing, the both of them interacting with each other.
Okay, so I want you to prop up that dystopian vision as fully as you can. I want you to walk me through what would happen between now and then to make those increments seem plausible. But what would you say to someone who thinks that the last few minutes of your utterances was just a lurch into the very alarmism I disavowed, right? I mean, what would you say to someone right of center who thinks that nothing really out of the ordinary is happening except for the fact that we finally have an administration who is willing to take the crime problem in these democratically mismanaged cities seriously, right? So all Trump wants to do is, first of all, he's implementing the very immigration policy that he ran on. And in truth, I don't know where the numbers stand now, but last I heard, he hadn't deported many more or even as many people as Obama had in one of his terms. You can correct me if I'm wrong there. But I mean, so it's like the number of deportations have not been astronomical. there's just been a lot of noise around them. And the number, you know, the numbers aside, he promised to do this and now he's doing it. And half of America clearly wants him to do it. And everything else, bringing in the National Guard or even the 82nd Airborne into a place like Chicago, is just a response to an ambient level of violence there that every American should find intolerable. And he's not doing anything tyrannical. He's just restoring order, the order that most people in their heart of hearts would really want. And basically everything you just said is some species of left-wing paranoia.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to set it up. And it shows that the challenge of trying to hew to the center, because there's a lot of truth in what you just said as a kind of hypothetical rebuttal to what I said. So, for example, I think it is true that Biden very badly mismanaged immigration. It's not even clear exactly why, if this was coming from the president himself or senior advisors who simply took over for him when he was, you know, relatively incapacitated and not attending to that, maybe distracted by Ukraine and other things going on in the world. And so he handed it off to advisors and let them handle it. Whatever the cause, it was not handled well. There was a kind of reflexive sense, I think, among a lot of Democrats that Trump had been already pretty tyrannical about immigration because of the child separation policy and the Muslim ban and so forth in the first administration, and that therefore, once Democrats were back in charge, it was important to reverse course, to stop relying on COVID-era restrictions about letting people come in the country and wait out their hearing on this side of the border, when in reality, many of them can simply sort of disappear into the woodwork of our enormous country and so forth. So if that's what you're saying, that all Trump is trying to do is kind of reinstitute the rule of law after a period where it was insufficiently defended, there is some truth to that. And there is some truth to the fact that he won the election and a lot of people who voted for him felt strongly about that issue. Where I would push back is in saying what is so alarming about the way Trump is handling immigration is the way it's being imposed. As you note, it's true. If you look back at the number of people who were deported or sent back at the border under Presidents Clinton, under President Bush, under President Obama, and then compare that to either the first Trump administration or now, it appears that Trump isn't doing all that much. There were something like 10 million people returned, or again, either at the border or within internal deportations under those other presidents, a little bit less under Obama, but still way more than Trump. But those presidents did not send in ICE officers with their faces masked, with no badges visible, to raid employers, detain people without proper charges. Quite often, people who, in fact, are not here illegally, but are legal immigrants with green cards or even American citizens. And it's this sort of haphazard, kind of over-the-top displays of aggression and violence and seeming lawlessness by officers of the federal government that has people extremely alarmed. Again, almost as if what Trump wants to do is have a kind of camera-ready show of force for his most right-wing supporters and kind of winkingly to those supporters, hoping that that provokes a reaction from the left that will then justify it retrospectively and justify him doing even more in that direction. And that is bad. Now, on the broader question of crime, I also am in the middle. I am all in favor of prosecuting crimes, keeping our cities safe or making them safe if they aren't. I've written critical things about the way a lot of democratically led so-called blue cities handle homelessness and crime in various ways. that isn't something that I want to defend. And I think Democrats often have walked themselves into political weakness by responding the way they do to these issues. The problem, once again, is that within my lifetime, at a time when, say, I lived in New York in the early 1990s, New York City had over 2,000 murders per year. It's now something on the order of 10 to 20% of that. Other cities, even those like my own Philadelphia that have higher rates of violence, they are still, it is still lower than it used to be. And then again, with like Portland, did Portland have a big problem around 4 to 5 years ago through 2020 with Antifa and protesters, clashes with the police, areas of the city that were kind of occupied by left-wing vandals? Yeah, but that was 4 to 5 years ago. That is a very minimal problem now. And there's no real precipitating cause that would justify treating this as some kind of national emergency in the present moment. And it is, to my mind, a kind of tell that the administration is attempting to do that in a way that involves, I think, little more evidence than often telling a story. If you look at Stephen Miller's posts or tweets on what used to be called Twitter and now X, you will see that he's just telling a story in which we live in a country in which there is an organized wave of left-wing terrorism going on. And that is just simply delusional. That is not true. Our country did have a problem of organized left-wing terrorism in the early 70s, when in a period in between 1971 and 1973, there was something like 500 terrorist bombings.
Yeah.
They didn't kill that many people, but they blew up banks, post offices, other public areas, often at night. There's really nothing remotely like that going on now. And simply saying that it is doesn't make it true. So I would just urge the Trump administration and supporters, as well as those on the left who are spoiling for a fight with ICE and so forth, to just kind of rein it in a little bit and recommit to looking at the reality-based community and treating reality as a thing that everyone should be able to agree on certain basic facts about. And I'm disheartened by how little sign there is that especially the right wants to do that. The left has its problems and does some of that. But it is also the case that even with all of the ICE provocations, the raids, the masking, the lack of badges, you know, grabbing people off the street and manhandling them, throwing them into unmarked cars and driving off with them, with all of that, we really haven't seen widespread left-wing violence, riots, and so forth, like we did, for instance, in the summer of 2020, with, I think, far less provocation. You know, I mean, in the sense, of course, I think the George Floyd killing was terrible and worth some protests, but, this is a systematic act of the federal government with the president leading the way with very incendiary rhetoric. So given that fact, I think actually the left has been remarkably restrained, not in the sense that I'm saying like they should be doing more and more violent things, but simply I might have expected them to be more violent given the recent history of how the left has occasionally behaved in the face of other provocations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the rhetoric has certainly been appalling. I mean, everything out of Stephen Miller's mouth suggests that he's vying for some kind of banality of evil award. I mean, he's just so clearly an awful human being in addition to everything else that is wrong with his politics. And I do think that the lack of civility and the indulgence of conspiracy thinking, all of this is just frankly dangerous, right? It's not just words. It really is raising the temperature in ways that are dangerous, and it's making certain terrible outcomes far more likely, as well as just attesting to the callousness and delusion of the people in power, right? So it's all terrible. And yet many people will say, well, these are just words, right? You should be taking him seriously, not literally. And so it goes for every one of his courtiers and concubines and enablers. What Trump has done to our politics has scared a lot of people left of center, but it really, it's not on a continuum with, now again, I'm just bending over backwards to be charitable to people who disagree with us. It's not on any kind of continuum with what we mean by authoritarianism, much less fascism. This is a reality TV show, right? This is all theater on some level. Not much is really is at stake. They're creating a vibe. And yes, it's understandable that people left of center are alarmed, but these are not the sorts of people who are ever going to put people up against the wall and shoot them. Like everything that is being, that, you know, alarmists like, and again, I'm being ventriloquized here, alarmists like Timothy Snyder and Anne Applebaum and, you know, all these people, the scholars of totalitarianism and the unraveling of democracy, all these people are hysterics and they're drawing bad analogies to other cases. What we have here is somebody who's just has a very different style. Right. And so, and the masking of ICE, that even has its own exculpatory explanation. These guys are being doxxed online. And this is a new moment where social media is posing a real risk to law enforcement. So they have to be masked. And if they're a little rough around the edges, well, you know, these people are here illegally. You know, if you don't want the laws enforced, you shouldn't have these laws in the first place, right? Everyone's guilty of a crime who's here illegally. It doesn't matter how long they've been here. It doesn't matter how profitably they've been working in necessary industries. Again, we have laws on the books and now we're enforcing them. So what is clearly wrong with that level of insouciance around the current situation?
Well, I would say that liberal democracy as a form of government, it's a form of government where what matters often most of all is how things are done, not so much what is done. So, you know, again, I have no objection to enforcing our nation's immigration laws. There was no outcry when Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama deported all of those millions of people. They somehow managed to do it without sending masked and badgeless people in and kind of giving them quotas and then sending them in to kind of random businesses where they get tips and behaving in such a thuggish way. And it matters for the perceived legitimacy of what the government is doing that the government acts as if it is following norms of procedures that apply to everyone. Mm. And that includes even people who are not citizens, because a lot of our rights apply to them, or they're supposed to. You know, there was a judge last week who came down with a ruling about, actually a Reagan-appointed judge, who came down with a ruling about the way that the Trump administration early on was trying to intimidate people protesting on campus about Israel and Gaza. And I, you know, I have very mixed to negative feelings about a lot of that. But, you know, it is a violation of the First Amendment, even for non-citizens, to be intimidated about what they're saying, to threaten them with violence or deportation purely for what they say and without proper procedure. And the judge pointed out that the goal in this case, in these cases, was to intimidate not just the people who were directly finding themselves running afoul of the law, but anyone else who might be inclined to say something a little more critical about these policies. And so for me, to be a principled liberal is to say that how things are done matters very much. And we have to follow, again, rules that apply to everyone, and to do things in a way that earns the legitimacy even among those who live in our country and are our fellow citizens who disagree with the substance of the policy. People who believe we should be much more lenient about immigration need to be told, well, the rules, the laws that we as a country have passed say something different, and we're going to enforce them. If you disagree, you have to elect people who will change those laws. And in the meantime, we're going to enforce them. But we're going to enforce them in a way that you as an American can say, all right, this is fairly done. This is the way it's supposed to be. Now, I would also add that just beyond immigration and ICE and these issues that we've been focusing on so far, There's also a very real concern that I and many others have that we are seeing far more than just, say, a show from a guy who's cosplaying as a tyrant. He has, and his administration has been attempting to expand executive power dramatically on two dimensions. First of all, you could say vertically within the executive branch, effectively saying this is the so-called theory of the unitary executive, which a lot of Republicans have been in favor of, at least since the Reagan administration. This says that everyone who works in the executive branch is answerable to the president. The president should have total oversight of hiring and firing them. And this includes even people who are in positions that Congress has created the positions, including if the position is designated as a so-called independent office of oversight within the executive branch. Trump wants to say, even in those cases, I'm the boss and I can fire these people. Now, does that make him a tyrant? Not necessarily. Again, a lot of Republicans for decades have made the argument that this is actually the way the executive branch is supposed to function. It's unconstitutional for there to be these so-called independent people within the branch. And again, following your example, Sam, I will say, well, let's accept the strongest case for that is that, well, how democratic is it for there to be these people who are put in positions deemed independent and they're untouchable by the political branches? How is that democratic? Shouldn't the person who's holds the only office in the country that all of us vote for, the president, shouldn't he be able to get rid of someone who is defying what he wants to do, saying it's inappropriate? Why does the independence of that person who has no democratic accountability override the power of the elected president? So, okay, fine. But Trump is also asserting executive authority vis-a-vis the other branches of the federal government, both over the federal courts and over Congress. The way our system is supposed to work with the separation of powers is that if the president has that ambition to rule sort of unilaterally over the other branches, the way we stop that is that one of the other branches has to stand up to him with its own institutional ambition to check it. So one would expect that ambitious members of the House and the Senate would say, you can't take our constitutional prerogatives from us. We are standing up for those prerogatives and we're going to fight for them. And then you have a constitutional crisis potentially between the presidency and the legislative branch, Congress. And then you turn to the courts to try to break that conflict and decide in favor of one or the other. And you expect whoever loses in the courts would back down. This has broken down because our political system is so polarized and so narrowly divided that you have the Congress, both houses, narrowly in Republican control, and those Republicans are more interested in giving Trump and his voters what they want, because those voters are also their voters. They are so interested in giving Trump and his voters what they want that they are putting that ahead of their own institutional powers. They effectively are voting in favor of letting Trump have control of setting tariffs.
Yeah.
Constitutionally speaking, that isn't supposed to happen. And I think a lot of people on the center left and the left are kind of hoping, waiting on this and many other issues for the Supreme Court to step in and say, Trump can't do that. But I actually think that's unlikely without Congress standing up and actually saying, we're the wounded party here. We are saying to the Supreme Court that the Constitution gives us that power. And then I think the Supreme Court would be much more likely to say, yeah, this is Congress's purview. They're the ones in charge of this. But because Congress isn't doing it, you're getting a kind of repeated situation where a federal judge below the Supreme Court will sort of side with what the letter of the Constitution is without Congress making the case for its own. And then when it finally comes to the Supreme Court, they sort of back down, or at least indicate, sometimes through preliminary rulings, that they're more inclined to side with Trump, because it's as if Congress, sort of like the Roman Senate in ancient times, has decided, you know, they'd rather keep their perks and privileges of being in a powerful position without actually taking the responsibility of defying the usurping power in the other branch.
Okay, so once again, I'm mindful of anyone who remains in my audience. There may not be many of these people, but anyone who is fundamentally skeptical of more or less all of the concerns you have raised and are likely to raise in this conversation, I want to see if we can sharpen them up. I mean, I agree with you, obviously, that there's a profoundly worrying unraveling of all kinds of norms that are far more important than we realized they were before Trump came along. But I'm in search of some bright lines here. I mean, so between now and something truly awful and undeniable happening, what are the bright lines that, if crossed, you feel like you will be able to point to those moments and say, this should be objectively obvious to anyone, whatever their politics, that we haven't been here before, or we haven't been here in, you know, since the Civil War. And this thing that just happened, I mean, it could be the Insurrection Act, it could be something around the midterms, it could be defying the Supreme Court. What are the bright lines for you that, should this thing come to pass this month or next year, you feel like you will be able to plant a flag there and say, this is an undeniable breach of something fundamental to the health of our democracy? This is not a gray area concern where, you know, we have to agree to disagree about the significance of ICE being masked or not. What is on the landscape for you to be worried about at this point?
Sure. Well, first, I will answer the question, but first I do want to note that one tendency of what we seem to be, or what I fear we're living through, which is the sort of slow motion collapse of a lot of our democratic norms, is that they happen step by step, piece by piece. Yeah. And I will come back after what I'm going to say in a moment to actually once again sort of take up the strongest case on the other side, because I do think it's worth pondering and talking through. But I guess I will say this. I have worried for a long time, certainly toward the end of the first Trump administration and then building throughout Biden's presidency, which I thought fairly early on was floundering and that he would be very weak going into the election. So I feared for a long time that Trump would win again. I didn't quite think he would actually win as largely as he did, even though it's nowhere near as large as Trump himself and his supporters like to claim. But, you know, winning the popular vote for the first time, I didn't really think that would happen. But the thing that I have worried about most is a kind of tit-for-tat series of escalations between the administration doing exactly what they've been doing, which is sending in ICE masked without badges, manhandling people, being provocative, this leading to some, I think, limited unrest, which is then used as a pretext to send in military forces, which Trump has done selectively in a few places, Los Angeles, Portland, Chicago. He's talked about a few other places he's contemplating. The left then responding to that by beginning to act out more aggressively against soldiers. Something unpredictable happens. Either a protester or a few get shot, or a soldier gets injured or killed, which then leads to more escalation and a pretext that Trump will use and invoke the Insurrection Act. If Trump invokes the Insurrection Act and then does not rather swiftly reverse course and step down from that footing, and if Congress does not respond relatively quickly to an absence of him reversing by passing some sort of resolution calling on him to do it, then that's the red line for me, because, you know, I don't want to go all Hitler. I really do try to restrain myself in simply saying Trump is Hitler. I never said Bush was Hitler, despite ending up as a pretty severe critic of Bush. I don't think I've ever said that Trump is Hitler in any kind of a stupid way. I've been very circumspect about the fascism debate. Mm-hmm. I think there are certain parallels, but not others, and that it was unwise for Kamala Harris to go that way in the last few weeks of the last election, mm-hmm. for example. However, I would say that the Weimar Constitution in Germany during the 1930s was never abolished. It remained in force throughout the entirety of Hitler's reign. The way that happened was that they had an article of the Constitution that permitted emergency dictatorial rule. And because of the Reichstag fire early in 1933, shortly after Hitler came to power, he declared an emergency. The legislature in Germany went along with it, passed the Enabling Act and a few other pieces of legislation that sort of codified that they were in an emergency. And that was it. Hitler continued to rule dictatorially under emergency conditions from that point forward. I fear that the Insurrection Act is our version. It is our system's version of that article. I believe it was Article 48. Of the Weimar Constitution. And if he declares an emergency under the Insurrection Act, you know, like, for instance, I believe the last time it was invoked was under the first Bush, George H.W. Bush, in response to the LA riots. Mm. And I think in that case, it was totally justifiable. We had a major city in flames for days, lots of violence. Listeners might recall, Reginald Denny, a white truck driver, was pulled from the cab of his 18-wheeler and a brick was thrown at his head live on TV from a helicopter. You know, whole neighborhoods burning. And something had to be done. So George H.W. Bush invoked the Insurrection Act, send in some military forces to calm things down. And within a few days, it was over. The Insurrection Act was lifted. And we went back to normal, which is exactly what you would expect. But as I understand it, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but as I understand it, if the Insurrection Act is invoked, there is no internal mechanism to the law that stipulates that it lapses automatically. If Congress were to step up, as I said earlier, and actually pass a resolution calling on the president to do so, and if the president didn't do so, and then Congress went to the Supreme Court to demand that it side with Congress against the president, saying that the act was no longer rightfully invoked, that the emergency was over, then I think you would have a kind of soft button to push that would probably lead most presidents to back down. What I fear is that if Trump does this and the Congress is in Republican hands, that as with everything else they've done since the start of the second Trump administration, I fear that Congress will simply passively go along with it and let Trump decide himself if and when he's going to step down. And I fear he simply will not and will attempt instead to govern by placing not all cities, but any city where violence arises, living effectively under martial law. And if that happens, then yeah, for me, that's a bright line. That means we are no longer a proper functioning liberal democracy. We are running under some kind of authoritarian system. I think there's a very real question of if this were to remain in force until the midterm elections next November, and all of these cities are democratic cities, will they be capable of holding free and fair elections under such conditions? I guess it would depend on how severe the military rule is. But once we're having that kind of discussion, we're now no longer living under the same system. Even if the Constitution remains exactly what it was in paper, and all of the branches of government are sort of in place and still doing what they do, and we will have effectively lived through a transformation of that system into something very else, something different, something dangerous and worrying.
What do you make of the acts of vandalism effectively against our state capacity that we've witnessed? I mean, the undermining of American science. I mean, there are many things that Trump has done in his second term that I can sort of understand. I mean, I have a theory of mind about him and about his enablers and about the right-wing populists who support them as to why they would want these things. And again, more or less everything we've talked about so far falls into that bin, as much as I see it all differently and I view it all as incredibly ominous and disturbing. But when I look at the undermining, the explicit undermining of American scientific capacity, right, to the gutting of research, and just and many of the other things that he's done that have clearly diminished American power, right? This isn't a story of self-aggrandizement as a country. I mean, this America First mood is not translating into our country always taking the path of strength. In fact, there's just been some virtually masochistic moves in the direction of undermining our strength. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's another good question. It is baffling. I mean, I've written about this a fair amount because it is oddly paradoxical and baffling to see a movement that runs under the banner Make America Great Again, and so many of the things that this administration appears to be doing seems to be hampering American strength, power, vitality, competitiveness around the world, and not seeing things that are where we're clearly already very much leaders in scientific research, our universities being the envy of the world. It is baffling. It's almost as if Make America Great Again is keyed toward a vision of the country that's much further in the past than I think many of us assume. I think many of us who have grown accustomed to observing the American right think, oh, these are people who just want to go back to the 50s, because that sort of was the vibe of the Reagan administration and the George W. Bush administration, that like the problem was the Cultural Revolution of the 60s. And all we want to do on the right is, you know, roll that back, and then we could be back to kind of the good old days before sex, drugs, and rock and roll and the things that came from that in the late 60s. When I think actually the Trump administration is, they might not even be fully conscious of this, but I think there are some people in their orbit who are actually looking back at like the 1880s. Like, they literally are looking back at a time when economic historians talk about American takeoff, namely when our country first really hit the Industrial Revolution in a big way. The railroads were completed, and so we had major capacity to trade across our vast landscape, with the food products produced in the middle of the country going to the coasts and then being shipped overseas. We had the major industrial cities on the East Coast and somewhat on the West Coast able to produce, you know, lots of products that were being shipped all over the world. And you had very little regulation from the government. You had very little taxation. Most revenue was gotten from excise taxes, tariffs, and so forth. There was no permanent income tax. There were fights over that, but until we got to 1913, there was no official income tax on wealth and income. So you had, you know, the robber barons, you had the Gilded Age of incredibly rich people building things. And I think the Trump outlook is sort of, we want to go back to that. And some of the rather strange kind of tech bro synergy that you saw in the opening months of the administration when Elon Musk was so involved, I think was about that, that the idea was, we want this to be the AI administration. We want this to be the crypto administration. We want Silicon Valley firms to be kind of given the green light and every regulatory advantage possible, and just let that run like crazy, because that's going to be the Standard Oil, or, you know, the Carnegie behemoth for the 21st century. But going along with that is that, you know, Peter Thiel, for instance, is well known for thinking that going to college is sort of overrated, that, like, it's much better for talented young people to just kind of go out and start a business and try to build something, not go to a campus and become woke. And, you know, that this vision of universities that are kind of like huge, you know, black holes for resources, they don't really produce much, they're sclerotic. What we need is a kind of wound up Wild West mentality of people just going out, breaking shit and producing stuff without regulatory oversight and without the government sort of picking winners and losers and giving grants to some scholars and some sectors of the scientific community and others. It's a kind of amped up kind of old right libertarianism. You know, pure laissez-faire, back to that. Just kind of let the government get out of the way and everyone go hog wild. So that's sort of in the spirit, Sam, of the way you've set up a lot of these questions. That's kind of the most justifiable case. I would simply say to anyone who finds that appealing that the fact is the United States was a minuscule power at that period. Now, you could say we became a global power astride the globe in the decades that followed because of that, that sort of was the fuel, the rocket fuel of takeoff that basically we've been riding on for all of these decades, more than a century since, and that we're now running on fumes. And so we need to go back to that. We need more rocket fuel. And what I just described over the last few minutes, that's what it is. Well, but the fact is, I would say that we have a lot of rivals in this world. China, Russia is less so, but still a kind of geopolitical rival, even if economically they're much smaller than we are. But other ascendant countries, India, a lot of other Asian countries, Brazil, and so forth. And these countries, you know, they don't hesitate to actually do what I think some of us thought Trump wanted to do, which was much more of a kind of recognition that we need to be building our state capacity in order to compete. We actually need to actually not do less of funding research, but if not more, at least be smarter about it. Recognize that we have certain advantages in soft and hard power. And one of our soft power advantages is our universities, our industrial capacity, our scientific capacity, our research capacity, and that we need to be husbanding that and growing it, not gutting it in the hopes that out of the ruins of all that we've built since the end of World War II along these lines will come a kind of Gilded Age 2.0 economic takeoff. I think it's very risky, and I think it misjudges the way our competitors do business, and we're going to be hampered by it. I think we're going to be chaotic. A lot of the things that I think smart people on the center left, like Ezra Klein and his co-author who wrote the Abundance book, people kind of in that mindset, who rightly, Matt Iglesias is another one, who really emphasized the need for us to kind of intelligently streamline our regulations so that we can build things again, like a lot of our competitors can do. You need to do that intelligently. You don't just go through with a scythe and start hacking at stuff. You actually have to combine the government doing things to keep us safe, to do things intelligently, with also getting rid of red tape and obstacles to growth that are getting in the way. But like, that requires a kind of patience and intelligence that I just don't see this administration displaying.
So you just painted a picture wherein the core motive of those supporting the president and kind of his populist agenda from the top, the so-called tech bros, et cetera, that really comes down to money on some level. I'm wondering how much money and a faltering economy and dimming economic hopes explains the support from the populist base, in your view. I mean, how much of it is a cultural revolt against the elites, and how much is just the fact that there's a failure for you know, the various tides that have lifted some boats here, you know, the top 10% of our society, you know, have bypassed people at the bottom. And I guess you could broaden the view here. I mean, obviously, right-wing populism isn't just an American problem at the moment. It is a global sickness that you can see in, you know, across Western democracy, certainly. How much is economic, in your view, and how much is a response to what many have called the woke mind virus and the failures of the left to enact sensible policies around public disorder and immigration, crime, unregulated mental illness playing out in coffee shops, et cetera?
Well, I think it's a blend of both, but the best way to understand it and describe it is in terms of the latter, meaning that even when we talk about economics and whether, you know, this is mainly a function of, say, working class people in neglected parts of our country, say the post-industrial Midwest, who, you know, live in towns where there used to be factories and those jobs are shipped overseas because of globalization and free trade policies pursued by every president from Reagan down to the first Trump. You know, I think there is a lot of truth to that at a certain level, but the way it gets metabolized by the voters who support Trump is through a kind of cultural lens and as through a kind of negative partisanship. Those are on a very long list of things that those voters see as evidence of the elites doing a terrible job in running the country. And so they, I think, see those trade policies and the, you know, the actual lived reality of what it means to live in a town where there are no good jobs and the schools are terrible and a lot of people are addicted to painkillers, which is, I guess, more of a late 2010s story, since that seems to have declined a little bit. But, you know, if you've traveled throughout some of these regions of the country, there is a kind of depressive character. They seem to be often regions that, you know, time has forgotten. There's not a lot of vibrancy and growth going on there. And if you live in those areas, it's very easy to say, like, why would I think that the people running the country are doing a good job after decades of this? Like, this is what my life has become. And so, but again, I think the way those people tend to think about it is as a few additional lines of criticism in a much longer list that does involve some of the things you mentioned, the you know, immigration, crime, dealing with mental illness in cities, and then the what used to be called kind of the woke trend, where like making what seemed to be, I think to a lot of Americans, relatively trivial moral transgressions for things that 2 years ago weren't even an issue are suddenly like a fireable offense or will get you hauled before the HR department in your workplace because you said something or misused a pronoun that was never a problem 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. This kind of ever-shifting line of propriety in our public dealings that is set by some mysterious group of activists that you can't even like point to in your own community. Like, where did this edict come down? Like, why do we now have to talk this way? And like, who decided this? Who voted for this? Why is this happening? So that's part of it too. And all of this is a kind of a blur I think, for a lot of people that have just contributed to a precipitous decline in trust and confidence in our public institutions. And that is what is affecting democracies across the world. As you noted, and I, in my own writing, I try as best I can to put what's happening here in that global context. I mean, in the UK, we have a relatively new Labour prime minister who is floundering with approval ratings in the high teens to low 20s.
Yep.
Trump is in the around 43%. Starmer is like 22%, just to give some perspective.
On a good day,
The Reform Party, which is, of course, run by Farage, who is one of the big forces behind the Brexit vote. He started this new party, and it's leading in the polls by 10 to 12 points, with the Tories, the Conservative Party, in third place. So if they had an election now, this upstart, further right, harder right party would win easily. And that party is being dogged by Tommy Robertson's sort of far right populist movement that is having large protests around the country and sort of trying to push the Reform Party even further right. That's England. The French government has kind of is in a state of constant crisis. It's a national rally. Further right party could well win the next time they have an election. The AfD far right party in Germany is leading in some polls now. Italy is already led by its harder right party with Meloni. You know, the guy who Tusk in Poland, who gave people of my disposition quite a lot of hope a couple of years ago by defeating the Law and Justice Party after 8 years in power and seeming to be a revival of the center left. The center left lost the presidency a few months ago, and right now Tusk is floundering in the polls. So this is happening all over Europe. It's happening in other parts of the world as well. And it's the same sort of dynamic everywhere, where people who aren't thriving in the current economy, who don't live in large cities, are using the network effects of social media to gather together into a right populist faction that opposes those people in the cities who have been sort of running the show for the last few decades, whether on the center right or the center left. And again, the economic stuff that you asked about is definitely a part of it. It's in the mix, but it's sort of all blended together into a kind of broad-based rejectionism about those people.
Yeah.
Those people in charge in Paris, in London, in Berlin, in Rome, in Washington. And that's, I think, why a lot of these, the more centrist parties are struggling, is because they don't know what to say otherwise. They too, you know, I talked about maybe running on the fumes of the great takeoff 140 years ago. The center left has kind of been maybe running on leftover fuel and fumes that go all the way back to the New Deal and the Great Society for decades now. And they don't have a lot of new ideas. And those ideas have become discredited due to these complex forces that I just got done listing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the irony from my point of view is I'm quite sympathetic with many of these cultural concerns that right-wing populists would articulate as the kind of the center of their animus toward the elites. I mean, for instance, I mean, to take the problems specifically in Western Europe, which we really don't quite share in America, thankfully. But I mean, Western Europe, many of these countries, certainly most of them, have a real problem of unassimilated and perhaps inassimilable communities of Muslim immigrants who have reached a kind of critical mass where it's just, there's an undeniable issue here where you have, you know, in the UK, you've got hundreds of thousands of people at a minimum who declare they want to live under Sharia law and will, you know, take to the streets in, you know, openly undemocratic, illiberal support of Hamas or, you know, execration of, you know, normal values around tolerance and pluralism. And you have, you know, it's just a quite shockingly retrograde and theocratic aspirations in these communities. And again, we don't quite have this in the States, certainly to the same degree. I mean, we have pockets of it. We have a fake human rights organization, the Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE, which, you know, bills itself as the Muslim version of the ACLU, but it really is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood and is a, you know, certainly an Islamist and sinister organization. So it's not that we don't have issues, but in Western Europe, you really do have a kind of powder keg there culturally, which it's easy to see. If you're Tommy Robinson, there's a lot to point to as places where the house is clearly on fire and it's being ignored by liberal elites or so-called liberal elites. So it's easy to see the concern there. But and even here, I mean, I do view a lot of the, you know, the woke overreach and moral confusion, the abolish the police crowd, the pronoun crowd, the defenestrations as a result of transgressing all those new fake norms, the shrinking of the Overton window on every one of those questions. I view all of that as a kind of super stimulus, and I see why people have gone properly insane in response to it. I mean, I understand when Elon says that, you know, the woke mind virus is going to destroy everything and devotes his life to eradicating it. I actually understand that in my bones. I mean, I'm nearly as allergic to all of that as anyone on the far right is. And yet, I can still keep a sense of proportion here, and I can still keep all of these other problems right of center in view. Like the fact that someone like Elon, given his reaction against, you know, trans activism and the, you know, the unwarranted attacks on everyone high and low, you know, from J.K. Rowling on down, given that his response to that is to signal boost Nazis and neo-Nazis and anti-Semites and proper lunatics on his social media platform as though that were a corrective, I just don't see how otherwise intelligent people can't keep both of these grotesque developments in view, right and left. I mean, can you say anything by way of explanation of how otherwise, I mean, how do you explain the Tucker Carlsons of the world and their many fans? What has happened so that people can only keep, I mean, if Tucker Carlson's, you know, too manifestly unbalanced, I mean, just someone like Christopher Rufo, right, who obviously is smart and effective within his orbit, but for some reason can only aim his fire leftward, no matter how awful the ethical indiscretions that are occurring, you know, right of center in our politics.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything you said. I think, I mean, the way I look at it is, I throughout the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, and up till now, in the second Trump administration, I have tried very hard to hold the line, which is that, for want of a better way of putting it, the woke stuff isn't good. It's bad in and of itself. It's even worse because of the way it provokes the right and gives them, it kind of fuels their movement. And so that liberals need to take a stand against this and actually say, you know, we believe in liberal democracy and decency and self-government and treating people fairly and rights and all that good stuff. But this kind of cultural crusade, which is really what wokeism was slash is, if it's still even a thing, it was a kind of almost quasi-religious, most sort of like, I see it mainly as a kind of descendant of the old leftward mainline Protestant denominations, a kind of post-Christian moralism that isn't really operating at the level of political power. It happens within institutions through kind of getting everyone who works there to affirm that to be a good person, one must say and do certain things in their individual choices. It wasn't so much about we have to outlaw this or that. I mean, it did have that dimension at times. And unfortunately, the Biden administration did some things to, you know, really encourage these trends by encouraging with, you know, regulation through the education department and so forth. But that's not really where the energy was. So I'm all with you in being very critical of that. I think it's bad. I think it's good that it seems to be waning in the culture and has been for a few years now. But you have to make a distinction between that kind of power, which I was just describing, this sort of informal power through civil society, through a kind of moral shaming and suasion, and then on the other hand, the hard power of the state and politics. And what we've seen is, I think, the harder right, Trumpist right populist political movement, MAGA, responding to this softer civil society-based left-wing movement of the woke stuff and saying, what we need to do is seize political power and then use hard political power to beat that other kind of power back. And that's a kind of politics that, I don't know, is a little scary, because what it means, and we're seeing it right now, is effectively, instead of the state through, say, the education department and, you know, all the titles that they oversee within the federal code, instead of saying, well, the role of the federal government on college campuses is to just sort of have a very light touch and sort of oversee things to make sure they run efficiently, and then during the woke stuff kind of nudge things in that leftward direction a little bit. It's actually what we're now seeing is the Trump administration attempting to be much more aggressive in saying, we're going to cut all of your funding, all of your grants to every wing of the university, not just say, I don't know, humanities grants, National Endowment for Humanities grants to like hurt the English professors who are, you know, driving gender theory through assigning Judith Butler or something. Like, if they're not saying that, they're like going to where I teach, Penn's medical school, and canceling hundreds of millions of dollars of research grants as a kind of ransom in return for demanding that the university actively begin effectively leaning center right. Now, like, if they succeed in doing that, would a guy with my background teaching the kind of books I like to teach and my sort of political disposition 10 years from now, if that worked, would I be more or less comfortable on the campus of Penn? I don't know if it worked. Maybe I'd be slightly more like, wow, there are more people who are sort of centrist around. There are even some conservatives on campus, or more than they used to be. And I'm not a conservative, but I can get along with those people. I might, you know, have some fun there. The problem is that this is the government that has mandated this from the top down. Mm. And again, I think it's more the case that when the woke stuff was sort of coming during the Biden administration through the Department of Education, it was very much pushing through an open door. It's not as if like the Penn was standing there saying, no, 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 don't make us do these things. It was sort of like, yeah, of course we believe this because we're sort of progressive leaning people with PhDs and other advanced degrees. And that's sort of how we view the world. And we all agree about this. Whereas now it's the government using a very blunt instrument of, again, a sort of extortion, holding these hundreds of millions of dollars of grants as a kind of axe over the head of the university to demand that they conform to a predetermined set of ideological commitments. And that makes me very, very nervous as a kind of classical liberal who thinks, ideally, civil society should sort of be operating and unfolding on its own logic, with the state having a very light hand involved. And so last thing I'll say on this, you know, you mentioned Rufo. Rufo's a weird guy for me because, like, in some things he says, I think he has some good points, but he's so wedded to this view that his role is to cheerlead the Trump administration into acting a little bit like jackbooted thugs on college campuses so that the right will win for a change. And I think that is attempting to achieve a sort of classical liberal end through flagrantly illiberal means. And I think it's much more likely that he's going to end up empowering people who would like to push things far more, far further right than he personally maybe wants to. And that would include people like Tucker Carlson, whom you mentioned. And, you know, you asked what's behind him. I have no idea. I the guy worked for Bill Kristol for like 15 or 20 years at the Weekly Standard. And now he pushes anti-Semitic conspiracy theories every chance he gets. Likes, you know, floating the possibility, just asking questions. Did maybe Winston Churchill, is he responsible for World War II and even the Holocaust? Because he kind of goaded Hitler into it. I mean, I don't understand. Did he really come? Is he totally lacking in any kind of moral and intellectual compass and made a kind of bizarre economic calculus that his success as a media personality involves tapping into the untapped market of flagrant anti-Jewish sentiment out there in the American electorate? I don't know. That seems like a strange move to make, and yet the evidence that he's done something exactly like that is before our eyes and ears all the time.
Mm. Well, finally, Damon, let's bring religion into the conversation here. I mean, it's emerged a little bit in your discussion of wokeness as being a kind of a pseudo religion. I mean, by almost every measure, I mean, certainly every poll I've seen, the overt religiosity in America has diminished in the last 20 years. There are fewer people answering to the name of Christian. There are more people answering to the name of nuns or atheists. There's less church attendance, et cetera. But I don't think I was the only one who watched the Charlie Kirk Memorial and detected a level of Christian triumphalism, Christian nationalism, Reconstructionist, spiritual warfare notions that, from a secular point of view, all of it was fairly alarming. I mean, everyone didn't strike the same note. You know, conversely, you know, Erica Kirk struck a very beautiful note of forgiveness, which was clearly inspired by her Christianity. But, when you look at what the kind of overtly sinister anti-Semitism of Tucker Carlson's contribution to that day and Stephen Miller's lunacy, Jack Posobiec's, leaping from having been a Pizzagate confabulator to now being a Christianist firebrand. I mean, it's just that there was a kind of a call to something like theocracy of a Christian flavor there from the dais. I'm wondering, which is how does the religious landscape look to you? I know you've had your own journey, you're no longer the guy who used to write for First Things, but what does the Christian right's embrace of perhaps the least compelling Christian on earth in the person of Donald Trump mean? And how do you view kind of the rumblings toward theocracy such as they still exist? One further kind of rider to this question, how does this look post-Trump to you? I mean, because obviously somebody like J.D. Vance is much more conversant with right-wing Christian nationalism than somebody like Trump is. Where does all of this go in continued success right of center, if that success does persist?
Yeah. Well, it's a complex question, and the answer will have to be a little complex, but I do think it's an important one for us to get right. So first of all, I agree with you. Like, personally, watching the Charlie Kirk Memorial was a bit unnerving. It's strange to look out at a stadium full of people who are cheering views and a general outlook on the world and the universe and the kind of theological order of things in that way, because it's so far from how I look at things. I would also urge people, though, to recall that just as Trump is deluded when he's running for president and gives, you know, one of his rallies at a stadium with 20 or 30,000 cheering people, when he comes off the stage and he says, "I'm going to win in a landslide. Look at all those people." Like, the fact that, in a country of 330 million, that you can have, 70 or however many thousand people showed up at that event doesn't really tell you much. So I'm with you in sticking with public opinion data And that data shows very clearly that over the last two decades, the rise of the so-called nuns, people who profess no religion, as well as the numbers who profess either agnosticism or atheism, has gone up such that the country is more secular now than it probably ever has been, with the caveat that in the 18th century, we weren't particularly religious either. So, how do you compare that today to two centuries ago? I don't know, or two and a half centuries, I'm not sure. But certainly for a long time, it has not been this secular. And that this is continuing across the generations. Gen Z, despite there being some right-leaning factions within Gen Z, some of whom flipped over to Trump this last time, it is not showing up with an equal reversal on church attendance or frequency of reading the Bible or professions of actual commitment to a religious community. So the Gen Z is by far the most secular generation we've ever seen, at least in any time in the recent past. So I would say we don't have to worry about a kind of broader-based religious revival, sort of, you know, raising the prospect of the kind of theocracy some of us kind of fear in our nightmares. What I would say, though, that complicates this a little bit is that the religious right of my heyday, when I wrote the Theogons 20 years ago, is very different now. That religious right was actually, I think, somewhat more benign, despite the fact that it alarmed me then, because it was defined as attempting to bring genuinely biblically rooted moral commitments into politics, which I didn't favor, but for which the content of that was sort of, you know, not always that clear. It could mean oppose Roe v. Wade, but when it was Martin Luther King, it meant let Black people vote and sit at the lunch counter and ride the bus in the same section as white people, because that civil rights movement was motivated by biblical commitments for a lot of members of the civil rights movement. And even for the religious right 20 years ago, even if you disagreed with them, they were trying to bring certain moral commitments that originated from outside of politics into politics. And again, I was cautious about that, thought it could go too far, thought Bush was doing it too much. But what you're seeing today is something different, where I think the faith commitments of the religious right have blended with the politics of the contemporary Republican Party, by which I mean Trumpism, almost completely, such that if you are on the religious right today and a white evangelical Protestant, if you ask people, are you a Christian? And they say, yes. What they mean is primarily, I believe in standing against them, with them defined as the left, which is a sort of moral and political abomination that wants to destroy all good things. So the identity of being a Christian now means essentially the same thing it means for any member of the Trump electoral coalition. So if you're a Silicon Valley tech bro or a Stephen Miller sort of anti-immigration zealot, or you're a MAHA, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. anti-vax conspiracist, all of these different factions of the coalition that elected Trump in 2024 is sort of shoulder to shoulder with the religious right. And the differences between these factions has blurred such that the religious right is less religious than it used to be. And the non-religious right factions are more like the current religious right than used to be true, when the factions were back 20 years ago was the religious right, economic libertarians who wanted to cut taxes and spending, and then sort of, you know, foreign policy hawks who wanted to fight the war on terror. Like, those were the factions, and they got along with each other for the sake of winning elections, but they were really quite different. They were in proverbial terms, they were kind of the three legs of the three-legged stool of the Republican Party post-Reagan. Mm. Whereas today, you have a sort of unified front of anti-liberalism, anti-leftism, in which all the factions sort of agree about pretty much everything. They are devoted to destroying liberalism, destroying the left. And so, I mean, one last thing I guess I'll say about it is that I think the current, the kind of the religious right that was on display so much at the Charlie Kirk Memorial, the analogy I sometimes draw is actually less to historic Roman Catholicism and Protestantism, which, you know, it's not an accident that the separation of church and state arose in the West, arose in cultures that were marked by those faith traditions. Because however bad the mix of church and state was often in Western Europe over the centuries, there was also a big fight over the centuries in the medieval period over the two-sword theory. God gave two swords of government to kings and popes. Did he give two swords to the king to rule the political and the spiritual realm, or two swords to the popes to rule the political and the spiritual? Or did he give one sword to the kings and one sword to the pope? There were big fights about these things, and sometimes they even became wars. And although the liberal notion of religious toleration and the separation of church and state are different in all kinds of ways, they are at a deep level a kind of modification of that earlier intuitive sense that these things are different. And what I see emerging on the American right now reminds me more of the kind of religious political linkages that one associates with Eastern Orthodoxy, where you have national churches. You have Russian Orthodoxy, Ukrainian Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, and so forth. And each of those churches are intertwined with the state in ways so that being a good Christian and being, say, a supporter of Vladimir Putin are at some deep level, somehow they imply each other. That kind of modality of politics and religion is what I'm starting to get inklings of by this newfangled Trumpist religious right, where to be a good Christian is to vote for Trump. And to vote for Trump is to sort of at the level of identity signal to the world, I stand in favor of Christian civilization defined as everything that isn't secular leftism. Mm. So that's sort of, I guess, a bit of an ominous way to end, but it is a complicated one because it's something new. Yeah. And it's one in which, depending on which way you tilt your head and squint, you can say it either means that, like, our new religious right isn't even religious, mm-hmm. or maybe it's that everyone on the right is religious in a new way. And we have to try to make sense of it over the coming years and decades, I think.
Well, it's ominous and interesting, Damon. Thank you so much for your time. It's great to finally get you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'll be back, I hope. Mm-hmm.